Park versus City of Braidwood. Mr. Williams.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Joseph M. Williams. I'm attorney for the appellant, James Clark. I hope you bear with me. I've been having some cold problems this morning. I assume the court has read the briefs and is fairly aware of the facts. I might recite a few of them just to set up the parameters. It was our primary contention on appeal that the district court erred in prejudicially dismissing Mr. Clark's.
Now, did your complaint allege that you were unaware of this plumbing work or installation of pipes or whatever?
Well, the problem is that the complaint never alleged the exact date of discovery. It alleged that on or about within some time frame that's a little bit fuzzy, the sewer system consisting of pipes and sewer pipes was installed over a 37-acre area. Now, it might have been done all in 1997. It might have taken longer. That wasn't pled. But the problem was there was never any specific date by which Mr. Clark alleged, hey, I noticed this, I saw this, I was aware of my action. And that's one of the problems why we feel it was prejudicially dismissed without amendment, because how can you say as a matter of law with a tolling
was
applied?
Is the amended complaint in the record?
Or, excuse me, complaint, Judge. It was never amended. We asked for an amendment.
But, I mean, when you asked to amend, did you submit a proposed amended complaint with it?
I don't think that was required in the circumstances, but what we did
Pardon?
Do in the motion.
I can't hear you.
I don't think that was absolutely required, but what we did do, we submitted within the motion to reconsider all of the things that we thought had not been fully addressed and could be more fully addressed factually that we felt should be repled in an amended complaint.
But in your in that pleading, didn't you say that there were many facts and circumstances that could potentially be alleged, but you didn't spell them out?
Well, some of them we did, as to notice, dates.
But what did you spell out that would have put you within the statute of limitations specifically?
We may not have done it specifically, Judge, but we did.
But I don't understand. I thought whenever you move to amend your complaint, you give the judge the proposed amendment.
Well, Your Honor,
he's ruling in a void.
I think there's case law that I've seen that says that absolutely isn't required. But we did say there are factual areas here. There's a lot of them as to the dates of notice, as to whether this was done in one unit or in pieces, whether it's a single act or a repeated series of acts of which there's later acts, whether equitable tolling considerations apply, whether there's concealment. There was many, many facts that we had, you know, we could have pled to those issues but were not allowed to amend. And we felt that it wasn't a matter of law based on the bare bones pleading that was pled that it was absolutely barred by the statute of limitations. In fact, we cited a case called Shule, which I have later on in my argument here, that says to dismiss a complaint without amendment upon a bare bones pleading is a torturous thing. And that's kind of what we feel happened here. Because as a matter of law, it'd be very difficult to say that he knew of his rights by 1999. All we pled was in 1997 or thereabouts. The system
but you
was solved.
But I don't understand. Look, we actually have cases saying this. When you file a complaint and you give the date of the violation, and the judge looks at the date of the violation, looks at the date of the complaint, and sees that it's longer than the statute of limitations, the natural impulse is to dismiss, say it's barred by the statute of limitations.
Well, this is a.
So why don't you come back and say, no, you know, we didn't discover this until X date?
Well, the problem is this, Judge. There's many factors here that distinguish it.
Why don't you just tell the judge, we didn't discover, the violation occurred in 97, we didn't discover it until, you know, August 8th, 1999 or something like that, and therefore we're not barred by the statute of limitations. Why don't you just tell that to the judge?
Well, I don't recall whether I drafted this particular complaint or not, but maybe that would have been a better way to go because then we wouldn't be here. But the problem I'm raising now is that based upon the complaint that was filed, there was an adequate pleading to dismiss it prejudicially automatically because there was a lot of unknown things. For instance...
But see, the problem is, even if we go with you, I mean, the problem is when you come back to the district court and you say, look, there are these facts, you have to give the district court some of those facts.
Right. Well, that's
which
not
you
a
did
problem.
Not. You gave the district court sort of conclusions. We've got evidence here that we think will establish it.
Right.
But you didn't give the district court, or whoever drafted it, didn't give the district court specifics.
Well, one of the problems was some of those facts would have had to have come out in discovery because this was a procedure where a 20-foot easement was impeded and encroached upon in a 37-acre undeveloped piece of land. Now, that's a very large piece of land and a very small easement. It was also undeveloped land. It also was covered with various types of ground coverage as bushes, trees, weeds, and so on, and it was not all in one location. So consequently, there's a lot of question that we may have had to get into on discovery as to what was done when and when who found out about what, because this isn't something you see ordinarily. It's underground.
You're missing something which is really fundamental. You can't file a complaint and say, I don't know whether I have a claim or not. I don't know whether the statute of limitations has run or not. I want discovery. You have to allege a violation.
Well, Your Honor, I think we could have done that if we'd been given leave to amend. And here's the problem, because a motion to dismiss is not summary judgment.
What would you have said in your amended complaint about the date of discovery?
We would have alleged that it's underground, it wasn't seen, and he didn't have notice.
What would you have said was the date of discovery?
Well, I don't know that, Judge, off the top of my head.
Then how would you be able to allege a complaint that wasn't on its face barred by the statute of limitations?
It isn't barred on its face because, number one, an affirmative defense is what the statute of limitations
is.
No, we've
said in cases, look, if you say your rights were violated 10 years ago, and you bring a suit 10 years later and there's a one-year statute of limitations, the judge can say, look, this is a frivolous suit. There's obviously a defense here. Now, you can come back and say, no, Judge, that's not true because we didn't discover the violation until 9 years later. But even as you stand up today, you will not tell us what date you would allege the discovery occurred.
We believe there was equitable tolling, but one of the problems was...
Until when?
We believe until we filed the case in 2001.
So you're not arguing discovery, you're arguing that...
Well, let me, if I could get to this one point.
I mean, equitable tolling and discovery are two different things.
Well, we
just merged them together now.
That even if the complaint
you
wasn't...
You understand they're two different things, don't you?
Yes,
don't you?
We admit the complaint may have been inadequately pled, but we feel we should have been
allowed... But you can't even tell me whether you're arguing discovery, equitable tolling, something else?
Well, we're just saying there's a multifarious set of factors that were not considered when the prejudicial dismissal was entered.
The question is, what is your claim with regard to the statute of limitations?
That it shouldn't have been applied to prejudicially dismiss because, ordinarily, an affirmative defense of limitations...
When did you discover the violation?
Well, it's our understanding it was probably discovered in 2001. But then, see, that wasn't pled, and we don't deny it wasn't pled.
Did you tell the judge that you wanted to replead, and you
yes,
plead
we did.
That it was discovered in 2001?
I don't know if that was. I don't know if I was the one who argued it, and I don't know if that was said. But I do know that they were informing the court that there was, in fact, additional facts as to notice and time of notice that should be pled that could get around the limitations. But the thing is, even if the complaint was inadequately pled, ordinarily, being that a motion to dismiss is not based on an affirmative defense, and an affirmative defense was raised, it in effect turned the procedure into summary judgment. And we didn't get to submit any submissions to show those dates, which we would have done in a summary judgment procedure. Otherwise, an affirmative defense, we should have been allowed to plead another complaint to try to get around the deficiencies in that complaint. I see my 5 minute light is on. Am I using my rebuttal time? I better wait till.
All right, thank you.
My opponent says.
Skanker.
May it please the court, Michael Kankar on behalf of the defendant, City of Braidwood. The motion to dismiss I filed was a page and a quarter long. It said he didn't file his complaint within the statute of limitations. I used his express language in the complaint. The most liberal lens of construction towards that complaint, it happened in 1997. I concur that if he would
have... He said in his complaint it occurred in or about 97. He didn't decide to say when he discovered it, did he?
No, he didn't.
He didn't have to say it in his does he in his complaint?
He would have had to say so if he alleged that the actual act occurred outside the statute of limitations.
Right, but how are we to know on its face that it occurred outside the statute of limitations? He said it occurred in around 1997. If he had said something about when he discovered it, and it fell because of the statute of limitations, then clearly a motion to dismiss would lie. But if it's silent as to when it was discovered, why is it subject on its face to dismissal?
Because it's his complaint. That's all I have to go on. I don't think the rule charges.
Where's the requirement that he has to say that it was when the date it was discovered? If he does file a complaint that does speak to discovery date, and in fact it's outside the statute of limitations, then clearly he's pled himself out of court. But if he hasn't and it's silent, why is that not subject to the discovery rule?
Well, because even with notice pleading, it would seem to me that when a plaintiff who...
The implication in the notice pleading is that it's within the statute of limitations, is it not?
No. I don't see how you can allege something happened in 1997.
But statute of limitations is an affirmative defense.
Absolutely.
You don't have to plead that there's no affirmative defense.
If he would have pled, I did not discover...
No. That's a defense No. Look, the statute of limitations, that it was, 4 years from the violation of the filing of the claim, that's an affirmative defense for you to make.
Yes,
if you plead that affirmative defense, he can come back with discovery or equitable estoppel or equitable tolling. But he doesn't have to plead a defense to your affirmative defense in his complaint.
Well, I submit that he pled himself out of the case simply with the allegation that the constitutional violation occurred more than 2 years
ago. No, you don't understand. By the dates he used, he certainly raised a question whether you had a good statute of limitations defense, but he didn't have to plead that you didn't have a good statute of limitations defense.
Well, I don't know what there would more for me to do when a complaint says this happened 5, 10...
No, that's fine. You move to dismiss, saying it's barred by the statute of limitations. That's fine.
Okay.
But if he comes back and says no because I didn't discover it or because of equitable tolling or something like that, then, as he said, it becomes a factual issue and you move to the summary judgment stage.
I totally agree. If he would have put that in the complaint...
How would he have responded
to that, though?
He can respond to your motion to dismiss with a reply to your motion to dismiss. And in his reply, he says that I didn't discover the violation, and anyway, there was equitable tolling. And that knocks out your motion to dismiss. Then you can present facts, but then we're in summary judgment.
But that's not what happened, though, Judge. He didn't come back with any sort of...
Well, he came back with something. Obviously, he didn't do it well, but he came back with something to indicate that he wanted to make an issue of discovery or of equitable tolling. So why didn't the judge say, well, all right, there's an issue here, it'll have to be developed factually?
Because he has to flesh it out better than he did.
Why?
He said, I could...
Why does he have to flesh it out?
Because unless we... That's why we have the rules. It leads to a more efficient system. It may have not in this case.
Rule that supports you.
Well, what
are you pointing to?
The general notion that the rule...
That's all right. First you said there's a rule.
All right.
Now you're pointing to a general...
Well, I would say that Rule 15, which speaks to amendments of the pleadings.
It says... It's not clear. I don't think he had to amend his complaint. I don't think there's anything wrong with his complaint. The problem is that you read the complaint, you see a possible statute of limitations defense, and you plead it in a motion to dismiss. And if he said in his reply, well, I think the statute of limitations is 25 years or something like that, then you win. But if instead he replies by saying, look, I didn't discover it, there was equitable tolling, it's a fact issue, and so on, then you have to have an evidentiary hearing.
I think if he would have said what he tried to say with more certainty, with a modicum of facts to support the mouthing of estoppel, the mouthing of discovery, the mouthing of those things, then the judge could have properly granted leave to amend the complaint or stricken my affirmative or stricken my motion to dismiss or deny it.
Or converted it to a motion for summary judgment.
That could have, true.
Well, speaking of the equitable tolling point, he says in his response to the motion, based upon the fact that the trespass was underground and not readily apparent, there could well be equitable tolling. Isn't that enough?
Well, I think I note in my reply brief that you can take judicial notice that to dig a sewer line, to dig a water line, you got a trench. It involves, it's not like it goes underneath the ground surreptitiously. It involves digging and trenching on someone's property, 37 acres, and that would seem to me to be a conspicuous activity and one that would be difficult for the city to hide.
So you could have attached an affidavit and you could have said, you know, a trench was dug on X date. You didn't do that.
I understand that,
Judge. We don't usually take judicial notice of building methods. Digging methods.
I understand, but what I'm getting at is the it seemed to me that the four corners of his complaint and even his responses didn't allow for any sort of reasonable construction of an equitable estoppel argument or a fraudulent concealment argument or any of those arguments.
It's not that. It's equitable tolling that he's talking about, or discovery or failure to discover.
And I will say that the bulk of the response to the motion was really spent on talking about the continuing violation doctrine and how that was really applicable under state law to the claim. And I think it's clear that the continuing violation doctrine deals with accrual.
Well, and so how does it apply here, that doctrine?
Well, I don't think it does.
Why not?
Because there was one wrongful act with, at best, a lingering effect of the discrimination into the...
Why don't we call it a lingering effect? It's a permanent effect. Not lingering. It's not like the digging causes some terrible harm which gradually dissipates. The digging, I mean, basically, he's claiming that this is some improper easement. His property has been taken from him. Well, that's permanent, isn't it?
It is, but I think that the case law says that the failure to undo a violation does not constitute a fresh act of discrimination. So the failure to remove...
That's begging the question, whether that you're assuming is one violation. The question is it one violation in 1997, or does it continue as long as you're... I mean, he views you or the city of Braidwood as kind of like a trespasser. I mean, suppose someone comes and sits on your land. He's just a squatter living in your house or something. Now, does the statute of limitations begin to run when he starts squatting, or does every day on which he's a trespasser constitute a new violation?
Well, that is a tricky question. I would say I would say that the cause of action accrues upon his beginning to sit on my front lawn.
But there is a concept of a continuing trespass, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
So what cases would that be applicable to?
The continuing trespass cases that plain the state cases, he cited a lot of them deal with continuous intermittent flooding, for example, that someone did something to the drainage which caused the water to flow off and on over a period of time, the similar sorts of wrongs from one single...
Why is the flooding different? So there's something happens, and as a result, there's continuous flooding of a person's property. Well, something happened here, and as a result, there's this thing, these pipes under his land. So what's the difference between the pipes under his land, which maybe reduced the value or something like that, and the flooding?
because the nature of his damages were, not the extent necessarily, but the nature of his damage was more or less frozen at the time the act occurred, within reason.
Thank you, Mr.
King. All right, thank you.
Mr. Williams.
I have time left, Judge?
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Oh, well, originally, that was the main thrust of our arguments, was that the limitations is irrelevant because it didn't apply based on the continuing trespass doctrine. And we did cite considerable case law to that in our brief, including the Zimmerman versus Willowbrook case, the Chicago Title and Trust versus Weiss case, and the Coffey case, which are all on page 9 of our brief. And some of those do involve pipe systems, and find that the continuing trespass doctrine applies when the trespass is both permanent and ongoing. The only thing that would be contrary to that, which was cited by the defendant and by the court, one case, was that case where there was a placement of signs on a piece of property, and the court, which is a federal case, by the way, the court had held that the signs were a one-time act with ongoing damages and not a continuing trespass. But I would add there, it's distinguishable because it isn't underground, number one. It's federal, number...
Why is that a difference?
Well, the thing is, when would you notice something? If
no,
it's
no, but that has nothing
it.
To do with a continuing trespass. That's your statute of limitations issue.
Well, also, pipes have not just the initial trespass of the pipes. They have the continuation of flow of water and sewage, which comes on repeatedly, just like in the flooding instance, so that you have a continued action, which you don't have if it isn't pipes and sewer pipes.
Is that what you want damages for, that these... That
no.
This is dumping sewage onto your property?
The damage is that the municipality allowed the placement of the pipes on Mr. Clark's land for some other person's use.
What is the harm to your...
Because his land now cannot supply sewer and water to his own 37 acres, which he was planning to develop as single-family lots.
Okay, so he's not complaining about sewage being dumped.
No, he's complaining about he can't use those pipes.
The particular injury of which he complains, that occurred when that preventing him from having his own water supply, that occurred when the pipes were installed. That's not something that happened afterwards.
Well, it's an ongoing problem, Judge, because he cannot tap into those pipes as they currently exist, having that they were put into too small of a size for him to tap on, which requires a lot of additional expense, and so he's lost $800,000 in the ability to develop his land.
So when did he realize that, when he decided he wanted to develop the land, and so that would...
We believe that he found that out when he was beginning to develop it in 2001, but I wanted to rebut to what was said earlier. The fact is that he doesn't check his land frequently. It's well known that developers bankroll vacant land for later development, and the fact that whether they're trenching or whatever, if you look at the land once a year and it's vacant, nothing's going to happen to it, it's not going to run away. He didn't necessarily know until he began to develop it, which was in 2001. And again, the problem was, we feel that what happened here was we were turned into summary judgment from dismissal without having the ability to supply anything new, and then we weren't allowed to amend if there was a problem for a dismissal. So we were caught in a trick bag between the two procedures.
You were not turned into summary judgment. That's what you wanted.
Well, essentially, that's what happened, because a judgment was rendered on an affirmative defense, which isn't what's supposed to happen on a dismissal motion.
Are you sure equitable tolling exists in the state of Illinois?
Well, it exists under federal law, and procedure, you know, applies from federal law, but the substantive state law applies as to the predicate act for the 1983.
But in 1983 cases, it's the state doctrine of equitable tolling that governs.
Well, the state has an equitable, both federal and state, I believe.
That's not clear, actually. I think
there is equitable tolling in either, though, frankly.
In Illinois.
Yeah, I think you're stronger to rely on your discovery.
But in any event, I guess my time's up.
But let me just ask this question. Did you ask Judge Conlon for discovery, for further discovery?
I believe we did.
In response to the motion to dismiss?
Yes, and we asked for amendment to get into many things, and if we couldn't have an amendment for discovery and for a number of other things, as far as I recall, but it was summarily granted.
Is there any appearances in court on this, or is this all...
It was just two.
It's just any argument?
Very short. It really wasn't much argument. So that's the problem. We feel that there was no reason not to allow us a shot at amending it, or if we're going to have a summary judgment, let's have an evidentiary hearing. Let's make some submissions, and we think we could have defeated it. I mean, she just assumed on the face of it, and like His Honor stated, we didn't have the duty initially to rebut what he may or may not have ever raised as an affirmative defense. And then after it was raised, that's when we lost the opportunity to do anything else because our hands were tied. We felt an amendment would not have been out of place.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Thank you.
Thank you, judges.
Case taken under advisement.